Good morning, this is Kevin Olenek, Director PERS. Before we start the agenda, I want to go over a few items. First, this meeting is being recorded and the audio will be available on the PERS website. As this is a hybrid meeting, we may experience some technical difficulties. Thank you in advance for your patience. We will have board here in full and some of the staff will be presenting virtually. If you're online, you'll see a window showing all the board members at their usual seats and a copy of the agenda on the projector screen behind them. You may also see a window showing an in-person presenter with their camera on when appropriate. A few other items to note. As always, public testimony will be taken on action items at the chair's discretion. We did not receive any requests to present oral testimony on any agenda items for today's meeting. And with that, I will turn the meeting over to Chair Shenoy.
Thank you, Kevin. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the December 22 Oregon PERS Board meeting. I'm Sadhna Shenoy, Chair of the Board, and I call this meeting to order. Board members, if you would please introduce yourselves.
Lawrence Rostall.
Stephen Buckley.
Jordan Jaramillo.
John Scanlon.
Thank you. The first item on our agenda is approval of September board meeting minutes. Any questions or comments on the minutes as presented? Hearing none, do I hear a motion to approve the minutes?
Lawrence Brunstall moves to approve the minutes.
John Scanlon, second.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadhna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Frenstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you all. September board minute meetings are approved. Next on our agenda is the director's report by Kevin.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, Vice Chair Frenstall, board members. For the record, Kevin Olenek, director. Welcome to the December 2nd, 2022 board meeting. For board members, a quick reminder to identify yourself when you're speaking so that we can reflect that accurately in the minutes. And presenters, please put on your camera when speaking. As always, we have a very interesting agenda to work through this morning. A2 director's report, as noted previously, a summary of items the board should be aware of, with an overview of recent agency accomplishments, the focus of the report. Forward-looking calendar, we've included future board meeting dates, all tentatively scheduled for 9 a.m. Of interest to the board is that the upcoming OIC meeting next Wednesday, the major agenda item is their finalization of their capital market assumptions and assumed rate of return based on their asset liability study. With respect to the OPERF investment report, October returns show regular account earnings of negative 3.31. Budgetarily, we have a projected variance of about 4.5% right now. A3, I'll present the 23-28 strategic plan for approval based on discussion at the September board meeting. Then Matt Rickard will present the board scorecard report with respect to measures as of September 30th. On the administrative rulemaking front, Stephanie will notice two rules and recommend adoption of one rule. Following that, Heather Case will provide a legislative update, present the final legislative concept drafts, and seek approval for legislative advisory committee members. Yvette will provide the board with an overview of Senate Bill 1049 implementation efforts. Then Jake Winship will provide an overview of the results of the Secretary of State actuarial review. We do have Ryan Falls from Gabriel Roeder Smith attending virtually to answer any questions should they arise. And then the moment we've all been waiting for, C4 Milliman will be presenting the 2021 financial modeling results. Are there any questions on my report?
This is Sadhna Shenoy. Kevin, can you comment on the OPSA first wage project that you've mentioned in your report?
Yes, thanks, Chair Shenoy. So with respect to that, as noted in there, this has been a long-standing item where there was some confusion with respect to contributions due for OPSERP members. So over the last while, there has been a significant effort led by Brandon Armatis, who's the manager of data services and helped in many ways by Fanon Tran and Kim Johnson, as well as other operational staff. in collaboration and partnership with their finance division. So they went through and cleaned up a significant number of accounts over the last while. And as you can see, close to 36,000 member accounts were cleaned up. So great effort. And the finance part of it, because there was some monies that were allocated from their contingency reserve, will be taken into account when we account for the preliminary and final earnings. So a great team effort by the staff.
Wonderful. Thank you. Long-standing project. Can we keep going? So A3 is the strategic plan adoption for 23-28. Kevin?
Again, Kevin O'Lank, Director. So as you recall from our September board meeting, we brought back or brought to you for consideration some of the strategic plan objectives, goals, etc. We got your feedback from it. We then further refined some of the goals and objectives, primarily around things to do with staff and staff development. There was some overlap in the IT and finance areas. And so we consolidated those into the strategic plan. We also then took all the goals and objectives, and using our POBMS measures, we applied those measures to all the goals and objectives and tactics such that we can report on the progress as we work through the next 5 years. And so we brought it to you with a recommendation to adopt the 23-28 strategic plan as presented. Are there any questions?
So I have a question about the risk pillar. So in our previous five-year plan, we had ERM as a strategic goal, and that's been changed this time around to risk management. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit, what the change has been?
Certainly, Chair Shinoy. So as we went through it, in the last one, we put in enterprise risk management because we wanted to set up and get that enterprise risk management program going. As we looked at this iteration, the 23-28 strategic plan, we had a discussion about enterprise risk management versus risk management. And risk management is a more holistic overview. We didn't want people just to focus on the enterprise risk management program itself, getting it set up. So we added in, as far some of our goals and objectives, the setting up of enterprise risk management, information security program, the privacy work that we're undergoing, such that it's a broader view and not just scoped out to the enterprise risk management program and getting that up and running.
Thank you. Any other questions from the board? Okay. If not, we are looking for a motion to adopt the 23-28 strategic plan.
This is Jordan Jaramillo. I move to adopt the 23-28 strategic plan as presented.
Lawrence Fernstall seconds.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadhna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Wonderful. Strategic plan is now adopted. The next item we have is the board scorecard report by Matt Rickard.
Thank you and good morning. Chair Shenoy, members of the board, for the record, I'm Matt Rickard, our central data coordinator, and I'm also representing the PERS Outcome-Based Management System Council, or the POBMS Council. Today I'm presenting the board scorecard report for you, which highlights a key selection of measures from our enterprise-level scorecards. This report covers performance during the third quarter of 2022, and I'll share a few of the highlights and key takeaways in just a moment. But first, I wanted to revisit and update you all on the POBMS Council's efforts to review our enterprise measures. During the last presentation at the May 27th board meeting, I shared with you that the POBMS Council is reviewing and updating enterprise measures that have been consistently underperforming versus their current targets. To date, we've made revisions to six or seven of those measures, and One of these revisions is also my first highlight with the call wait time measure. Now, we reviewed and updated the call wait time measure and arrived at a target of 10 minutes and a green range of 12 minutes and under. This quarter, we experienced a call wait time of 9.5 minutes, which places a performance in the green range for the first time in 7 years. Under the previous outdated ranges, this performance would have landed in the red range, despite significant improvement on behalf of our phone team. So this is certainly a success story associated with these measure revisions. I also wanted to note with this measure that members have the option of triggering a callback via our Phonolo callback system after holding for 4 minutes. So the members that are waiting on hold to speak to someone after this point, they're doing so at their own discretion. So now looking to our overall outcome and process measure performance, we definitely saw some improvement this quarter. The pie chart in the board materials reflects 9 more green measures than at our last board report in May. And this puts the quarterly green performance a full 12% higher than it was back then. As for the individual measures on this report, 5 of the 8 measures performed in the green ranges. There have been 10 consecutive quarters in the green range for both estimates and eligibility reviews completed, and 7 consecutive quarters in the green for accuracy of calculations. With our system uptime measure, we experienced the best performance in nearly 10 years with 99.75% uptime. Now, while we experienced these positive performances, there were also 2 of the measures that performed in the red range, and 1 of the measures continues to be missing data due to technical issues with the data collection tool. So to help add some context around those red performances I mentioned, here's a few details and mitigating factors. With the timely benefit calculations measure, there was a significant increase in death calculations received, and at the same time, that death team had already been working through a backlog of accounts. Now, the death team has since reduced that backlog, and their performance has improved over the last month. With our recruitment efforts, the 8-week time frame for this measure remains challenging to meet with current market conditions. In this quarter that we were measuring, we had only 2 of the 12 recruitments that were completed in that 8-week time frame. So as a result, our executive leadership team has taken a look at the calculation for this measure, and they've approved an alteration to that calculation. This measure will now be calculated on a basis of 8 weeks from requisition to offer instead of the full completion. Now, this will ideally mitigate for those occurrences of declined offers, but it will still allow measuring of PERS on its recruitment efforts. The next board scorecard report will be presented at the June 2023 board meeting, and that will cover results for the first quarter of 2023. That's the board scorecard summary in a nutshell. Do we have any questions or comments from the board today?
Questions? Thank you so much. It's good to see the positive direction that the scorecard is moving in. Thank you so much for all your effort.
Thank you.
Moving on, the section B is administrative rulemaking. Stephanie Wan.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. I want to make sure everyone can hear me.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Stephanie Wan with PERS. We have a really quick, only 3 items in our administrative rulemaking section today. First up is item B1 with a notice of our return to work rules. This affects both the Chapter 238 members, so Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP members. By statute, members are eligible to receive creditable service or retirement credit for the period during which they receive workman's comp. The amendments to these rules clarify when that period of disability for PERS purposes ends, and that is when they return to work, understanding that once they return to active membership, they will be receiving retirement credit or creditable service under the plan normally. This is notice only, so no action is required. We do anticipate bringing these forward for adoption at the February meeting. Item B2 is notice of our employer reporting rules, and this is really housekeeping. We are moving rules around. We are moving currently rules regarding employer reporting that currently reside in Division 70, which is specific to OPSERP, back to Division 9, which is specific to employers. To avoid any confusion, a lot of people assume that rules that are in Division 70 apply only to OPSERP members. So we're moving it back to, or we're combining two rules actually, and moving them into Division 9, where it makes more sense, as that division regards just the employers. This is notice only, and so there's no action to be taken at this time, and we do anticipate bringing them forward for adoption at the February board meeting. Item 3 is adoption of the OSGP trading restrictions rule. As a quick reminder, we had a restriction regarding making transfers from the stable value fund to the self-directed brokerage account. This restriction was put in place due to a concern that one of our vendors had. That vendor no longer has that concern, and so there's no need for that restriction anymore. And the amendment removes that. We've had no public comment and no changes to the rules since notice, so we're seeking a motion to adopt the rule as presented.
This is Stephen Buckley. I move that the board adopt the Oregon Savings Growth Plan trading restriction rule as presented in the agenda packet.
Lawrence Fernstall seconds.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you all. So moved. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Next up is Heather Case, bringing us the final legislative concepts draft.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Heather Case. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor at PERS. My memo is lengthy. However, at the end, I will only be seeking one action for the board, and that is a motion to approve the appointees to the Legislative Advisory Committee for the PERS board. First, just briefly touching on the 2023 legislative session, which will begin January 17th. It is anticipated to last until mid to late June. PERS has its agency bills, which you all know of, which I'll touch on in a second, and we will be ready to provide information to folks regarding any bills that come forward that involve PERS. I will say, just as potentially wild speculation on public record, I've been really proud of the agency's ability to form relationships with both lobbyists and legislators to be aware of concepts that are coming forward before they are actually dropped as bills to the legislature. So PERS is aware of small concepts that are coming forward, nothing on the level of Senate Bill 1049, say, that I know of, for example. So we are looking forward to, of course, another busy, yet productive session. September legislative days and December have happened. December legislative days are scheduled for next week. Both of those, PERS has no items that came before or will come before the legislature. We were, as you know, looking forward to confirming a new appointee to the board. That will not be happening. You will notice, if you're like me and check the legislative website obsessively, that there are a few appointments that are coming up. However, in general, the governor has brought, the outgoing governor, Kate Brown, has brought no appointments. So luckily, our esteemed vice chair, Mr. Fernstall, has agreed to stay on. We are anticipating a February now confirmation of a new board member. So
Which year is that?
Good question, Chair Shenoy. Hopefully 2023. And we do appreciate your continued service, Mr. Fernstall. Vice Chair Fernstall. Moving on to our agency legislation for the 2023 session, we have our final drafts of our bills from Legislative Council, which have been attached to our memo. As you can see, we've got three bills. They have not changed substantively from draft to final. So the presentation here to the board, these concepts are the same. The modernization cleanup bill, as you know, is an effort to clean up inconsistencies in the program in advance of modernization. These do need to happen, I believe, regardless. However, the agency, as we look forward to modernization, has moved these up in priority before we begin any new programming, which, of course, is off in the future. So we had multiple drafts. This is a very long and intimidating-looking bill. However, we have to include the whole language of the statute that we will be changing. These changes are very technical in nature, and there's only a few that are quote-unquote substantive. When they are substantive, they are usually typically aligning standards with agency practice. So implementation-wise, it should not involve changing the programs and the actions of the staff. The second concept, our increase to our divorce process decree processing fee, is the same.
Heather, may I ask you a question?
Oh, of course. Yes, Chair Shenoy.
Is this in any way going to help us with the funding for the modernization program? I mean, is there any urgent sort of standards that have to be upheld that might make the legislature give us some more money for this program?
Thank you for the question, Chair Shenoy. Unfortunately, no. I do not believe that this bill will increase any urgency on the part of the legislature regarding any funding, because this is mostly aligning a statute with our current agency practice. So at this point, there is no detriment to members per se, or any urgency in that regard that is being cured by this bill. So unfortunately, no. Although it is connected to modernization, I don't believe it will increase the urgency of our funding. Appreciate the question. Our increase to our divorce decree processing fee will increase the fee from $300 to $1,300, as the board knows, and adopted in administrative rule in 1996. This fee since then has always been far, far less than the actual administrative cost to process divorce decrees. And we are statutorily required to seek fees for the administration of divorce decrees. So we are looking to align this cost more closely with our actual processing costs, and then going forward, tying this to CPI for a yearly increase. That way, we do not have this problem of this extreme increase again. Third is our Social Security statutes cleanup. This is truly a cleanup. It is deleting amendments to, or deleting references to, Social Security statute that actually no longer apply to PERS, because PERS no longer has the authority as Social Security administrator in the state. Finally, the PERS Legislative Advisory Committee. So I came before you in 2020, and this was actually after I started in May of 2020. So this was, I believe, October of 2020, after I had just started, and asked the board for the same thing, for appointment of a legislative advisory committee for the board. This committee is to advise the board on legislative proposals that the board wishes to make or come before the legislature to testify on. As you know, the committee must include an equal number of members representing labor and management. We do have a few changes on the list from 2020. However, it is mostly substantively the same. The folks who are new, Tyler Jansen from the Association of Oregon Counties, and sorry, just a quick note, the organizations that these folks are representing are the same as 2020, but the folks who are in those positions has changed. So Tyler Jansen from the Association of Oregon Counties, Tom Crawford, now Courtney Graham from SEIU. Tom Crawford was the new PERS government relations specialist at SEIU. He has informed me as of, I believe, Wednesday that he left his position, and so he asked that Courtney Graham be put in his place on the committee. So I wanted to put that on the record. I changed the memo yesterday at the last minute. So so just to inform you guys in advance of your vote of that. And then Kendall Mason is the new representative from the Oregon Education Association. All of the new members have been contacted. They are willing to serve, and continuing members are also willing to serve. I will go ahead and pause here and just ask if there are any questions or statements before I ask the board for a vote.
Quick question. What is the cadence of the interactions that this committee has with staff of PERS?
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. Most of these, in fact, all of these folks are stakeholders that the agency engages with quite frequently in pursuit of our own legislative concepts that we introduce. Most notably, we have a very large stakeholder meeting where we include government relations folks and lobbyists from all of these organizations, and we had that in February of 2021 in advance of our bills that are being presented to the 2023 legislature. So these folks are all of the same representatives. So they all have a very close relationship with PERS, I would say, and a high level of interest in the agency and its actions.
So the purpose of this committee is then to be on call if needed for advice. Is that fair?
Chair Shenoy, members of the board, I think that is fair. I had a pretty similar question, and I've had a question about kind of what does this committee do separately from the agency in terms of assisting the board, and what's its purpose? And I looked in a little bit to the statute, so ORS 238.660. So the board, separate from the agency of PERS, has an ability to approach the legislature. So you all can, as one board, approach the legislature on your own, not as fiduciaries, but as policy advisors. The way that I see it is that this ability is in place and available separate and distinct from the agency. I see this coming up more when there are disagreements between the board and the agency and how legislative concepts should be reported on, or opinions about legislative concepts. The idea of the statute is if the board chooses to exercise this ability to go before the legislature as policy advisors, that they must consult this advisory committee before doing so.
Thank you.
Yeah, John Scanlon here. I'm reading through the divorce decree increase, and it presents itself as a cap. So the idea being it could be less than that, right? But that doesn't sound like it's very typical, right? So could you speak to that? And also, who pays that? Would that be split between the two people, or does it come out of their account, or how does that work?
Thanks. Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Chair Shenoy, Board Member Scanlon. I appreciate the question. And in fact, the PERS Retirees Incorporated folks asked me the exact same question when I presented this concept to them. So yes, this fee is a cap. And when it was $300, it was never exercised as a cap. So there was never less than $300 charged, because almost immediately our costs were always more than that. $1,300 is the average cost of processing a divorce decree now. There is the ability to charge less than that for less complicated orders or decrees. Right now, most of our decrees are still more than that. So we can take a look at that, and we do have the option of charging less than that $1,300 if needed. We do foresee with the implementation of our modernization program an easier way to track individual hours spent by the divorce unit and our specialty qualifications to be able to delineate. Right now, our tracking system is manual, and right now it is burdensome on the unit to track the number of hours. However, we are still finding that most of our decrees are over $1,300. Because this will raise yearly in the future, we do want to keep that a cap as opposed to a straight fee charge so that we have the ability to track and charge less when appropriate. As far as how that fee is actually paid, so the fee is assessed when a divorce decree is processed, there's an alternate payee account created for the former spouse who is not a member of PERS. And the creation of that alternate payee account is really where the money kind of comes from, where the cost comes from. And at the time that account is created, that's when the fee is assessed. So usually that's when the divorce decree is entered on the record by the courts and submitted to PERS. That is not usually when the member is retired. It may be any time within the member's lifetime with PERS. So the fee is assessed, interest is not charged, and the fee is not required to be paid until a distribution is actually made from the member's account. At that time, the fee is split half to the member and half to the alternate payee, and it's assessed on that first payment or that first distribution out of each of those accounts.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there any other questions or discussion? Otherwise, I would seek a motion from the board to approve the appointees to the Legislative Advisory Committee.
John Scanlon, so moved.
Jordan Jaramillo, second.
All those in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Frenstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Mio, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
So moved. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, and members of the board.
Next up on the agenda is Yvette presenting Senate Bill 1049 update.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, Vice Chair Fernstall, members of the board. For the record, Yvette Elledge-Rhodes, Deputy Director. I'm here to present an update to the Senate Bill 1049 program implementation. As reported back in July, the program continues to be in red status. This is due to the Member Redirect Project work package complexity in both Work Packages 8, EPSA Death, and Work Packages 11, EPSA Reemployments and Adjustments. Both of these work packages not only build upon previous deployments for retirement calculations, but our business rules for EPSA Death scenarios are very complex. We've also had some minor impacts to deployment dates due to other agency projects, such as our ACH Treasury Key Bank transition, which is scheduled to deploy in early February. So what are we doing to mitigate these issues? The project team, as I reported last time, where we were looking at reviewing, and we had started two different change requests. So we have finalized and developed them. They will be presented to our steering team next week for approval. The first change request removes one of our work packages, Work Packages 12, in order to include all the needed requirements for Work Package 8 and Work Package 11. Work Package 12 was a final backlog implementation package. We do recognize we still may have some items that we needed at the end of the program, and we are prepared to include that in our maintenance and enhancement in our normal operating process. But removing that work package would allow enough time for the remaining work packages to deploy by the end of 2024. The other change request adds our scope for Senate Bill 111A. This change is critical for the success of implementing Senate Bill 1049 as it relates to death. Inclusion of this change is necessary to achieve our EPSA system functionality. Without the change, the Senate Bill 1049 project will close with continued workarounds and manual processes that were still being used to calculate, apply, report, and close EPSA accounts, and also to track EPSA employer reserves. So the project team reviewed requirements, scope, the resources needed for these changes. They are going to continue to review the project schedule in order to determine what changes, how this impacts our schedule. So we're going to go through a rebaselining process. Proposed schedule dates right now have us completing all deployments by early 2025 so that we will still have time for a stabilization period. This change also includes rescheduling work packages 9.1 and 9.2 out a couple of weeks to March 23rd. A deployment date because of the ACH Treasury transition. And so we included that change in these change requests so we could approve them at our steering team next week. All other activities on the program are making progress as expected. We continue to monitor our risks and the other agency projects to make sure impacts are addressed timely. And I feel we're still making great progress. We're getting to the end of this very long replanning process, and now we can see the impact to our project. So at the next update, we'll be able to let you know what the new deployment dates are, and we'll just continue to make progress. I'm available for any questions if you have any. It's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Yvette, for your report. No questions from the board yet. Thanks, Yvette.
All right.
Moving on, we move to the Secretary of State Actuarial Review Findings, Jake Winship.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Jake Winship. I'm the Actuarial Manager at PERS. Also on the line is Ryan Falls, and he was the lead actuary in the production of this actuarial audit report. And he's available if there are any technical questions about the procedures of the audit or any questions that I may not be equipped to answer. So he is calling in remotely and is available. As a background for this, this is part of Oregon House Bill 4163. And basically the idea is that the PERS actuarial reporting, and particularly the valuation reports, are subject to a periodic audit to make sure that the methods and assumptions used are appropriate, and that is the scope of this report. The first one was in 2019, also by GRS, and this one is the second in the report. We have a number of findings that I'll summarize here. Essentially, what I've included in the letter that's in the board packet is the executive summary, and then we italicized some of the context within the report itself so that the casual reader doesn't have to go into the depths of that to understand. A very high level, I think this was a very positive report. They found that the assumptions and methods were appropriate. In particular, they called out our rate coloring program. It's my understanding that in a prior report, there was some contention whether this form of output smoothing was appropriate. There are no such concerns with this report. They did find it to be worthwhile, and particularly some of the measures implemented based on the 2020 experience study where we prevented premature reductions to the UAL amortization rate. And certainly with the current year results, we are thankful that those were put into place, and they agree with that. Just to go in some of their key findings, if you'd like, or at this point, I'd like to ask if there are any questions that we can address.
Mr. Winship and Mr. Falls, this is Steve Buckley. The question I have is that it's top of page 2 of your report, Mr. Winship. There's a discussion about the 18-month lag from the actuarial evaluation date until the new contribution rate takes effect. And I understand that 18-month lag in the contributions. What I don't have a good grasp on is the recommendation made by GRS as to how that gap might be closed, and whether the essentially what that recommendation is from GRS to address that 18-month contribution gap. So I turn that over to either you or perhaps Mr. Falls, the author of the recommendation.
Absolutely. Well, I will take an initial stab at that, and obviously Ryan, as he's able to give more clarification. My understanding is essentially there's an implicit assumption when there's a calculation of a unfunded actuarial liability amortization that essentially it is identified as of the measurement date. So in this case, it would be 12/31/21. And there is an implicit assumption that the amortization starts immediately. So it would apply to payroll as of 1/1/22 in this case, and then all the contributions would be made there. That's the basis as that's the opinion that they are based on that assumption, whereas the reality is both payroll increases according to actuarial assumptions over the ensuing 18 months, as well as the contribution goes into place. So essentially what that would do is it would reestablish those bases, saying there's a passage of time and therefore inherently both the payroll will increase as well as the unfunded liability because of the accrual of interest, and therefore the factors applied, that contribution rate segment of the unfunded actuarial liability would be a different number if you take those increases into account than if you don't. And I'll turn that over to Mr. Falls if he can clarify it all.
Sure. Thanks, Jake. Thank you for having me today, members of the board. And I think that was a pretty good summary. It really just comes down to timing adjustments. And just the idea that interest adjustments a dollar today is not necessarily worth a dollar tomorrow. You have a really good funding policy that basically identifies every dollar of unfunded and sets up a payment schedule to pay that off over a fixed period of time. And just because of the slight disconnect in timing, the 18 months, there's a little bit of loss in interest charges, essentially. But the way the funding policy is set up, whatever gap there is in the next year, the next base that's set up in the next rate setting valuation, it gets corrected and it gets allocated. So it's all self-correcting. And so there are some techniques just to make the adjustments for that timing gap. But I will say, I know this is something that and Matt can speak to in more detail, but I know it's something that Milliman's talked about in the past. You already have a fairly complex rate setting process, and this just adds another degree of complexity to it. But there are some new actuarial standards that are coming out that are more direct about saying this timing lag needs to be addressed. So we just, you know, brought it to the attention, wanted to bring it to the attention of you all as the board and started a discussion with Matt about it and Millman. And it's just a small way to enhance an already, you know, really strong funding policy.
Could I try and say back what I think I heard there? As I understand it, in that 18-month period, we have an assumption of return. I'll round it to 7%, right? An assumption of salary increases, salary inflation, if you will. Let me round that to 4%, let's say. And because the salary increases against which the rate is applied is less than the assumed interest, we would fall, if everything worked perfectly, we would fall a little bit behind in that 18-month period, but it would be caught up in terms of where we are. But the other thing I just wanted to note is that during that 18-month period, the actual return would swamp that difference. But the auditing point here is that we have a sort of small systemic gap built into the estimate because of that difference. Is that roughly what's going
on? Yeah, I think that's a very good summary. That's essentially the issue. And as you mentioned, kind of two different points. As Ryan mentioned, it does true up throughout the system. And basically, it does incorporate the actual salary increases as well as the actual financial return. So each period, that unfunded actuarial liability is recalculated. And then going forward, it's just as Ryan mentioned, there is a sort of a systematic lag in that implementation. And because of the guidance in the forthcoming actuarial standard of practice, they really had some guidance that recommendation we ought to address it more explicitly than we have in the past. I that's how I interpret the recommendation.
I think that's fair. I would just also add, it does cut both ways. If the new base is a gain, it's not always, we're shorting the fund. There's a shortfall. It's possible we're giving, it goes both ways. So it is symmetric, I guess is what I would say. But, and it's possible that, the board decided in consultation with Millman that, you decide it's just the added complexity. I think there's, in some of the reporting, it makes it complicated. You just decide that, this lag isn't something that's worth the additional complexity, but it's the purpose of actuarial audit. It's for us to have a conversation about it and just decide and give you an opportunity to talk about small ways to enhance the process. But, sometimes the recommendations, aren't right for you all, but the purpose of it is to have this conversation. So, and we're having the conversation. I assume you'll have a follow up conversation with Millman at some point and you'll all decide if it's appropriate for you. So
this is Sadhna Shenoy. I have more of a procedural question. We've already talked about the financial implications of the lag. Are there systems in the world of retirement systems all over the country that actually don't have a time lag that, true up the effects of this early? I can't imagine that we are the only ones with this complexity and who prefer this way of doing business.
I do not perceive there's any, I don't think it's possible, as you mentioned, for any pension plan, particularly of any size or complexity, to not have some lag associated. I think it's more the materiality of the lag being 18 months, whereas some other systems may have a shorter lag, and in particular, less than a one-year lag. And sometimes that can be significant because obviously the further the lag between the value, the measurement date and the implementation date, the more discrepancies will arise.
And just to add to that, given the fact that we're on this biennial cycle and we need to publish rates at a certain time for them to take effect, just inherently the way that the system is set up, it does bring into the fact that it's a longer lag than some. If you set your contribution rates on a yearly basis, obviously there's maybe a 6-month lag we set ours on a biennial basis, so there's that 18-month lag.
I welcome any other questions, or if you'd like me to continue through the recommendations just at a very high level. The next section addresses the actuarial valuation results. These are more of a technical critique, and really it has to do with the timing of decrements, the appropriateness, whether some of the assumptions ought to be reconsidered. And I think in each of these cases, not to speak too much for our colleagues at Milliman, I think we'll have discussions over the next few months, and they do plan to have a written response in preparation for the board at the next meeting in early February. Unfortunately, the timing did not allow for it for this meeting, but we will address those and try to consider each of the recommendations individually. The next item is a little this really relates to an actuarial standard of practice, number 56, and it addresses modeling, and in particular the development and ownership of models. This is a relatively recent standard of practice, and I think, again, this will be part of our ongoing discussion and really reflect upon the applicability of the ASOP and how that can be satisfied in the evaluation report. We also have some recommendations, some recommended edits for the evaluation report that we've received from our employer advisory group. And some of them are similar. They address some concerns about added detail with the site account amortization process. We've also had some suggestions, concerns about the executive summary. So that will be part of our ongoing discussion. Actuarial staff has discussed internally. We're creating some mock-ups that we hope to share with our colleagues and come to an improved actuarial evaluation report that incorporate some of these suggestions from both the audit report as well as our EAG group. And so finally, as mentioned in the report, we will ensure that the recommendations are addressed in a timely and appropriate manner. We appreciate the insight provided by GRS, and we feel like this is a strong document. It's an indication that our processes are on the right track, but there's always room for improvement, and we will have another evaluation in a few years.
Okay. And then Milliman will provide us with some responses to these comments at the next meeting.
Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah. Will Milliman provide us with responses to the comments made in this report?
Yes, that's my understanding. We discussed it briefly, and it is my understanding that they will provide a written response to these recommendations at the next meeting.
Any questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Falls. Thank you to GRS for your efforts, and thank you, Jake. Next up is Milliman team. Actually, not team today, a single Milliman person.
I work alone. No. Scott is, we are doing hybrid actuaries today. Scott is a little bit under the weather. So to not add additional burden to our local healthcare system, there he is, feeling on as good a face as he can while wearing a jacket and presumably pajama pants. So, good morning, Scott.
No comment.
All right. Looks like you can see my screen. Okay. For the record, I'm Matt Larrabee with the Portland office of Milliman. I'm joined by Scott, and I certainly either at the start here, if you care to, or at the end, I can speak a little bit to the audit discussion if you'd like to with the UAL. I don't know if that, Chair Shinoy, what your preference is there.
I think it's okay for us to wait for your written report.
Okay, that sounds great.
Thank you.
All right, so given the hybrid situation, I'll leave the discussion today. Hopefully Scott will be able to keep the amount of fact-checking he does on my presentation to a minimum. So, we are here today to kind of talk through long-term financial modeling. This is on the heels of our recently completed actuarial valuation. This is reflecting valuation results and what we know about investment returns through the end of September, those that are published. And this is an exercise that we do every year for the board and for other interested parties to kind of make sure that the system under a wide variety of possible circumstances is on the right track. Okay. So we, as we've always done, we do this using two different models. Oops, I can't even see my own presentation. Pardon for a second. There we go. All right. We use a steady return model, so consistent investment returns in the future each and every year, and then a more complex variable return model. They each have their own strengths and weaknesses, so we use them both. We use the board's currently adopted assumption of 6.9% for investment return. We hold that as the discount rate assumption for all of the future valuations that we model over the next 20 years. And then the most important thing from this slide is there in the bold. We've incorporated the minus 4.41% published return through September 30. So we've taken that into account. We've got demographics basically through the end of last year because we get an annual member census. We roll those liabilities forward, and then we start projecting assets forward based on what we know through September of this year. Okay. So a few comments on system rates are in order here. Really importantly, and probably one of the biggest tricks with this, challenges with this presentation, is we treat the system as if it's one employer. One employer, I used to be able to say one employer with one site account. We now treat it as one employer with two site accounts. Kind of two-thirds of the money we view as being put in about 20 years ago. And then we have another slug of money that came in within the last few years due to some of the money that came in through the legislative incentives programs and things like that. So, you know, there's hundreds of employers. This is showing how the system as an average would work if it was one employer, but individual employers can and will differ from the results shown here based on that employer's particular pooling arrangements and circumstances, and particularly whether the employer has made the decision to create a site account or not. So, this is really more a reminder than anything. This was mentioned in the audit section. We have a rate caller process that was updated last year. We use the market value to set contribution rates. The market value, the snapshot date, was the end of December 2021. Because of the rate coloring mechanism, we basically took no credit for that and held those UAL rates steady rather than saying, oh, 2021 was good, let's move contribution rates down. More documentation. This is really here just for the public record. I won't go through these. The board has seen these slides enough, but if a new person looked at it, they could kind of get a sense of how the rate color works, which is it's restricting movement in the UAL rate. So we'll switch on to the steady return model first. We start with this because it is the easier to understand model. Of course, the fact that it's easier to understand also means it's less realistic. We model steady returns, annualized basis after September of this year for four potential steady return levels, 5% per year, 6.25% per year, 6.9, which is the board's adopted assumption, or 9.0. If you look out over about a 20-year time frame through our investment return outlook model, over a 20-year time frame, plus 5 to plus 9 annualized, that covers about half of the likely outcome. So it's from about the 25th to the 75th percentile of what we might see over a two decade span of time. We'll get to kind of the noisier model, which is more realistic after that. So really important slide from my point of view, the collared base rate. So the collared base, obviously it's a term of art that we have. This is really kind of the system funding before any adjustments for site accounts. So this is, you know, when we talk, the highest profile funded status number tends to be the one excluding site accounts. This is the contribution rate that we use to kind of claw at that number. What do we see as a pattern here over the next 20 years? I'd focus first on the blue line, which is returns at assumption. We actually see, if you look from 2021 to 23, out through 2029 to 31, you see a high degree of stability there. Slight increase in 2023. That's because of the adopted change in the investment return assumption. Oh, sorry. And the loss, the change in investment return assumption out of 6.9. Another little climb from 23-25 to 25-27. That's the hit that we've taken for the first 9 months of this year on the investment side. There was a little bit of investment loss, and then we slowly and gradually start to go down as we move to the right. That slow, gradual movement on the blue line. What is that? That's kind of rotation, kind of an agricultural sense, rotating crops on the active membership side. We can have higher and higher proportions of our overall membership that are OPSERP. OPSERP benefits are less valuable and thus less costly from a contribution perspective than the Tier 1, Tier 2 members that are being replaced in our demographic replacement model. If the investment returns do better, maybe something more like a 75th percentile return, we see the pattern that we see in the green line. We actually hold those rates still fairly steady through about 2029 through 2031. A 9% return is better than assumption, but it's not shooting the moon. So to get back up to 90% funded status where we'd start to ease off on the UAL rate, that takes a little while. That's why that green line hues pretty closely to the blue line. If we have modest underperformance, which is the gold, or more substantial underperformance in the red, you can kind of see the patterns there. Again, in this case, the way the steady model works, 5% return, it is underperformance. It's not, you know, over the span of time, that would be difficult. It's not earth-shattering in the context of a biennium or two, which is why those movements on the red line are relatively modest in the steady return model. We'll capture more of the true volatility when we get to the stochastic model.
If I may, this is kind of an academic question, but if the returns are linear, why are the pension rates, and I'm looking at all of slides 9, 10, 11, why aren't the trends in those rates linear as well? Why do they bounce around?
In terms of the returns being linear, so which line are you focusing
on? Well, it shows up more on slide 10. If you look at the base collared rate system average, it bounces around as you move through the bienniums.
Yep,
and it
absolutely
seems that with linear returns, that also would be linear.
So it's a great question, Board Member Jaramillo. The answer I would give, and then we'll see if Scott either nods or kind of adds to it or corrects, is that it's more than just return-driven factors. There's also demographic factors underlying it. We've got Tier 1 members, Tier 2 members, and OPSERP members, and we're trying, in our model, we've got every member modeled about what we think they will go out. And so the normal cost rate, which is, this is rolled up at a system level across all three tiers, that's going to change a little bit with the demographics as well.
Thank you.
Thumbs up or addition to that, Scott?
No, that's right.
Okay, good. I've got my phone a friend on the line today. So you got me ahead, Board Member Jaramillo, to the next slide here, which is really showing that the biennium to biennium changes, which is an understandable focus for employers and other interested parties. 1.1% increase. That's coming in July 23. That was based on the return, the lowering of the investment return assumption down to 6.9 from the prior rate setting valuation. And then there's that kind of relatively, but not perfectly steady or linear downward drift going on there. And the most notable non-linearity in the slide is the green line. You can see that the green stays within that negative 0 to -1% band through 2029. And then there's a big drop down in 31 and then a further drop down in 33. What is that? That's when we've kind of shifted through the gears. We've made it above 90% funded status. And so we're able to have more room to lower the UAL rate through the collaring mechanism, which is asymmetrical. Okay. So those are the base rates. Another focus, of course, is funded status. This is assets compared to liabilities as a percentage. Here we're excluding site accounts. You can see the effects of the 2022 year-to-date returns in this slide. We were nearly at 80%. We forecast that we'll be close to 73 to 74% by the end of this year. And if investment returns are at or close to assumption, we'll be in a fairly similar range to that number when we get to the end of 2023, which will be our next rate setting valuation date. Things that I look for in this slide, first I focus on the blue line. What is our pace to get back to 100% if we hit our assumption? You can see that that occurs between 2039 and 2040, which is good since we have 20-year amortization and we'd be dealing with a investment return loss that's happened in 2022. So that looks good. The other thing that catches my eye, I always look for the stability and appropriateness of rate setting, is the red line. Whatever is the worst scenario that we show, does the curve bottom out, and is the contribution rate policy robust enough that the funded status starts to recover? And the answer is yes. We have a, you know, kind of don't get down below 70% in that scenario, and then we start a slow but discernible climb after about 8 or 10 years, even in that negative return, kind of 1 in 4 scenario, if you will. So this is the same. Do you have a question?
May I take you back one slide?
Of course.
I'm sorry if I was dreaming and not paying attention to what you were saying, but I'm going to the biennial change in collared base rate, system average.
Yes.
And then we see that starting July 33 to July 35, all of the three, the 5%, 6.25, and 6.9% go up a little bit. And did you address that? Was I not listening to you?
Oh, I did not address that one. So, Scott, do you have a commentary on the dynamic that we have with the 33 to 35 change? That would be for the little the upward shift in the model for the last movements on the right.
Yeah, I'd have to double check looking under the hood there, but I think that may be tied to one of the things going on kind of in the funding policy here is, for example, OPSERP has amortization bases that drop off that have been amortized over 16 years. And so what can happen is you can have like a little surplus base that drops off and it bumps the UAL rate a little bit. It looks kind of magnified on this chart when you zoom in this far. But that's probably what those little wiggles are at the back end.
That's right. Thank you, Scott. We had investment losses in 2008, the 2008 investment losses on a market basis for OPSERP. OPSERP being relatively small at that point in time would have been first recognized in the 2009, the 2009 rate setting valuation amortized over, a 16-year period. Oh, and then we re-amortized things too, didn't we?
Yeah, okay. 22.
Yeah.
But OPSERP didn't get re-amortized the way Tier 1, Tier 2.
We didn't re-amortize
it. It still has bases, both plus and minus, from those periods that are dropping off. And so what we could have a gain base from that recovery after the financial crisis that it's relatively small because OPSERP didn't have a lot of money in play at the time. Right. But that could be what's happening here.
Yeah. And we also changed the cost allocation method at one point for OPSERP, which created a little bit of a UAL bump. And that would have been with the 2015 rates, if I remember right. 2013 rates. Yep.
And then another question.
Sure.
When the side accounts go away, do we have like a timing measure on that? We don't know if they're going to be replaced. So,
good question, Chair Shenoy. In terms of the site accounts, we model that about 2/3 of the site accounts are forecast to go away towards the end of 2027.
Okay.
So about 5 years from now. And then the rest of the site accounts, which is a lot of the new money that's come in the last 2 or 3 years, that is on a 20-year schedule and will be forecast to go away 17, 18 years from now. I mean, as a bit of foreshadowing, I would say, you know, if the board members reached, asked, you know, to summarize what was last year's experience study about, it was all about the collaring. I would say that next year's experience study, to a great extent, we're going to be talking a lot about site accounts and kind of the modeling, the tail, and how to handle that through the site account process as we kind of get closer to those forecast but not guaranteed expiration dates.
A quick question on slide 11. The reason the green line continues to soar above 100% funding is implicitly or explicitly in this, we keep having 9% returns, but we keep assuming 6.9 in the model at that point.
So that's part of it, board member Fernstall. The other part of it is I get to speak at least briefly even about the audit stuff.
Okay.
Is another reason that it's that way is the delay.
Okay.
Because the delay is not biased. So say your investment returns are going better than the assumption. Good investment returns, once the collar limitations are taken off, would lead to lower rates. However, those lower rates are not coming into effect for, wait for it,
18
months.
Yeah.
So that is part of the reason that continues to go in that direction is the 18-month delay.
Thank you.
You bet. Okay. So fund status, including side accounts, is higher. It was at 86%. We forecast it to be at 79. These do converge over time as those site accounts get amortized and pushed into the more general employer assets, if you will. So similar timing when you look at the right-hand side of the slide, 100% reached if assumption is met between 2039 and 2040. All right. So we talked about rates, we talked about funded status. Let's talk about the other dollar figure that kind of gets focused, which is the UAL or unfunded actuarial liability. This is the number excluding site accounts. We see that we're looking at, we forecast between a $6 and $7 billion dollar increase year over year due to the published returns through September 30. Of course, how that will actually play out will depend on what the markets do in the fourth quarter of the year. Again, focusing on the blue line, is that going down if we hit our assumption? And it continually is forecast to go to zero by the year 2040. And so, Ryan Falls in the audit from GRS talked about some of the standards of making sure that we've got methods and disclosures that kind of show, are the contribution rates sufficient that if you hit your assumption, you know, you're not building your unfunded liabilities up. And this is clearly demonstrating that's that the case. We've got a contribution procedure in place to address things.
And just as a note, you really get it on the funding status, I understand, but these are just sort of nominal dollars. They're not inflation adjusted or shown as a percent of payroll or anything like that. That's so even if you were still at 30 billion on the red line, 30 billion in 2040 is not the same as $30 billion today.
An extremely good point, Board Member Fernstall, that yes, that if you were going to cast these in inflation-adjusted dollars, even the red line would show decrease. It's kind of probably one of the difference between being an actuary for towards more of a budgetarily focused person. I'm going to talk a little bit about a few slides. These were coming to some extent to help Director Olenek in some of the work and interactions he does with folks down in Salem and with members of Treasury and the OIC in his role as ex officio on the OIC. These are a little bit more cash flow focused. There's been a lot of, you know, concern or stress testing about, you know, are liquidity concerns in terms of how the fund is invested. So this is kind of a demonstration on the liquidity side. The red line is showing where the assets would be if we earn 6.9% in the future. Currently around $80 billion and would steadily, under that modeled future return scenario, grow to $140 billion in non-inflation adjusted terms over the 20 years modeled. Contributions under the policy are in green. Benefit payments are in the blue, and the difference between the two, which is kind of your liquidity need, if you will, are the orange. So the plan, if we hit return assumptions, is forecast to be cash flow negative, which is an intentional design. It is not a concern over that period of time, but I think importantly it shows that how relatively small that cash flow need is, that liquidity need is relative to the size of the overall portfolio under that scenario. This gets rid of the red bar so you can see things a little bit more granularly and recast it. And I think this is an important way investment folks think about it, as a percentage of the assets at the start of the year. We're around 4% or so of starting assets every year is the projection for our net outflow. We stay between 3 and 5% under this scenario for the totality of the modeling period. Again, very important contingency if returns are at the assumption that we've adopted. So I said that the steady return model showed reasonable outcomes. This is the one item in the steady return model where I will show an unreasonable outcome over a period of time. This is cash flow under 0% return for 20 years. I've talked about 25th percentile, 75th percentiles. This is worse than a 1 percentile, first percentile outcome. This is like 1/3 of 1% outcome. No returns for 20 years. What am I looking for? Well, one thing is the cash flows become positive. The rates go so high contribution wise that we have more money coming in through contributions than we have going out through benefit payments. The other thing that we look at from a stability perspective, again, the red line, does it accelerate in terms of going down or does it stabilize? And we've got that stabilize and climb pattern, which is a really robust test of the structure of our funding policy and the responsiveness that we have to using market values of assets.
John Scanlon, question in that, and this is kind of, I guess, what you would call like the dark skies kind of, you know, scenario.
what would the employer contribution rate have to be to weather, you know, that kind of really harsh economic environment?
Okay, Board Member Scanlon, I know I'm not supposed to use colorful language as an X-ray. This isn't dark. This isn't just dark skies. This is dark skies with like trailers flying in the air and stuff like that. I'll filibuster while Scott looks it up in the model. But so I'll flow over here. This will give you a sense. So the non-investment related cash flow on the far right hand side would be about 5% of starting assets. This is from slide 17. And then if I go back to the right, you were focused on contribution rates, I should say. Contributions there are in the green. They would be 20% of the year's starting assets. And if I go back to the prior slide, starting assets would be around $60 billion. So 20% of $60 billion would be about a $12 billion annual contribution. And this is where I would look to Vice Chair Fernstall to jump in and say, but they're not inflation adjusted dollars. It's really only $9 billion of contributions or something like that. But, yeah. I mean, obviously our payroll right now is in the $12 billion range. So it might be in the $24 billion.
So if you were range, to compare that, on slide 15, I'm trying to raise Scott here, where if everything worked perfectly, right, we'd have about 4% contributions, right, on $130 billion, right?
Sure.
Compare that to 20% mm-hmm. on 60.
Yep.
Need my calculator.
About $12 billion.
Yeah, okay. So that
non-inflation adjusted.
Not inflation adjusted, but what it normally would be is the, roughly speaking, 4% on 130, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So it would normally be maybe $5 billion.
Five or six, yeah.
Five or six billion, and it would be $18 billion instead. So it would be triple.
Yeah.
And since the normal contribution, I mean, the regular contribution, is, you know, around that 20-ish percent, right?
Yeah.
You might be at 60%.
Yeah. 50-60% of payroll. And this is good. Scott, for the record, Lawrence got his calculator out as well.
But I do it in my head, I'm going to make a mistake.
All right. What do you want to say, Scott?
No, I would agree. I'd penciled out something similar that we're talking north of 50% in that scenario, yeah. Given the dollars at play and given where payroll would be expected to grow in this scenario. I mean, granted, payroll may not go to assumption in a one percentile asset return scenario because many things may be happening that dark skies and trailers flying. But.
Yeah. I remember being out with my wife at a winery in Yamhill County on a weekend 8 or 10 years ago, and it wasn't dark skies. The sky turned green. It was like, it's time to get out of here, because it turns out there were like wind funnels in the area and stuff like that. So that's the sort of scenario that it's a variation from what we've done normally with this model, but I think it's an important one from a transparency perspective for the folks at Treasury and the OIC who rightly, are concerned about these sorts of things.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about a tornado that lasts 20 years, right?
That's right. Yeah.
If one had lived in the Midwest like I did, green skies would be very typical. So.
Yes, absolutely. Somebody who's never lived in the Midwest, I learned what green skies mean, and I do not seek them out actively. All right. Any other questions on the easier model? All right. Let's go to the more complicated model, shall we? The variable return model. So rather than those kind of steady returns and just four lines, instead we run 10,000 scenarios. These were developed. We've got capital market expertise folks, credentialed investment professionals. We plug in OPERF's target allocation policy, including the recent changes that they've made. They've made some kind of little nips and cuts here and there to the policy over the last few months. And importantly, for these scenarios in the Milliman model over the 20 years looking forward, we're now at 7.33%. Our model, for the first time that I can remember in all the time we've done this, is above the board's adopted assumption. Now that's come at a price. The reason that our model is higher, we're quantitatively driven people, is price to earnings ratios are lower. That would mean that your real return expectations for equities going forward are better. Fixed income yields are higher. That would mean that you can probably, you think your fixed income outlooks are going to be better. So, you know, there's a little bit of a modeling risk, you know, what's your input, what's your output aspect to the whole enterprise here. So our model outlook, which was based on market conditions through June, shows 733, and I'll get into some details on that. And of course, we are also incorporating the published returns through September in here as well. So to try to orient everybody, because there's 10,000 scenarios and you don't want to have 10,000 lines, instead we show these kind of like little lanterns or candles or whatever the heck they are. Orientation, always follow the dots. The dots are the median. They're the 50th percentile, so half the outcomes fall or above or below those dots. Half of the overall outcomes fall inside the light blue area. 4 and 5, or 80% of the outcomes, fall inside the dark blue area. And 90% of the outcomes, or 9 and 10, fall inside of those sticks, so those little thin bars on either either side of the big blue blocks. So that's the way to interpret the results. So, you know, the stochastic model is really about investment returns. Here we're showing what we model for investment returns each and every year for the 20 years. The only one that's a real outlier is 2022, because we know 9 months of the results, so there's a downward bias there. Even if we have a good fourth quarter, we would expect a negative return at the 50th percentile. It shows that. Most of our other years, we're kind of sitting there between 6.8 to 7.1 on a year-by-year basis. I like to kind of take the 2021 bias out of there and just look at, you know, what are the returns from the 95th down to the 5th percentile for our model, just the pure returns, not kind of incorporating the first 9 months this year. What do we see on the far right? 7.3% return at the 50th percentile. Our 75th to 25th runs from about 9.2 down to 5.4. So like I said, our steady return model, when we showed 9 down to 5, we're kind of capturing what we think will be half the outcomes. And on the more extreme end, the bars, 95th percentile over 20 years would be 12.1% a year. 5th percentile would be 2.9% per year, which kind of gets to my comment in response to Board Member Scanlon. When I'm showing 0% over 20 years, I've gone beyond dark skies to an even stranger and more concerning place.
The other thing, this is Barnes First, I'll just to note on this, if you look at any of the right-hand side ones, you know, that we would have a single year that would be -7 or +25 shouldn't throw us off as being really all that out of the norm, or give us particular reason to change any assumption, because with the assumptions, you're still in that range 80% of the time, and 20% of the time, which is a lot, you'd actually be, you know, beyond that.
Right. Absolutely. And to kind of build on that point, Vice Chair Fernstahl, you know, so, you know, if you kind of look at from on this is on the single year returns, if we look from kind of the top, which is 95th, to the bottom, 5th. So we've depicted 90% of outcomes. I've worked with PERS since I think 06. There's been only 1 year when the single year return fell outside of that range. It was the -27% in 2008. But of course, we measure things so that, you know, in 20 years, that's a 1 in 20 event. But then in terms of the way we measure assets for calculating the rates, we combine the returns for 2 years. And 2009 was a good year. And when you combine the bad 2008 with the good 2009, it ended up around a 10th percent biennial return in our model. So, you know, kind of going to the biennial model, I'd look at 2024. You know, we kind of combined, we're in that -3 to -6 annualized net range when we had 2008 to 2009. So I, you know, kind of the back testing in a way has made me feel comfortable that the model is appropriately robust, if you will. So this is just bringing in the 2021 returns. Don't really want to dwell on that. Instead, I'm going to move to rates. So this, again, these are the base rates, collared base. So this is the amount before any consideration of site accounts. The one that's kind of we're trying to claw away here at that 73 to 74% funded status, excluding site accounts, $26 to $27 billion UAL. What pattern do we see for the rates? Well, the first two biennium we show are dots because those rates have already been established. 24.5 climbing up to 25.5. What would be our forecast for the upcoming biennium? This will be based on where market conditions are at the end of 2023 and whatever assumptions we set. We see at the 50th percentile a very modest increase in the rates, 0.4%. What is that in response to? In response to the bad year-to-date market investment returns compared to the assumption. The other thing I'd note, and we call this out with the bar that's with the arrows there, is that there is kind of a very noticeable asymmetry to the 25 to 27 rates. It is more likely that we would move rates up in response to bad market outcomes through the end of 23 than that we would move rates down in response to good market outcomes from now through the end of 2023. What drives that asymmetry? The collar and the fact that we're currently not in close sight of 90% funded status, excluding sight accounts. You follow the dots after that, and those dots kind of following the blue line that we had for the steady return at 6.9 have that kind of downward drift to them. In this case, a little bit of modeled investment gain, numbers coming in a little bit, but modestly over the 6.9 assumption, but also officer actives replacing retiring Tier 1, Tier 2 members. And then if those were the overall rates, here are the changes, and you can kind of see the patterns here, the asymmetry that exists for the 25 to the July 2025 change, and then a relative more symmetry up or down when we get to biennial beyond that, when we have a full two-year period to have investment returns either go at assumption well or poorly for us. Moving on to net rates. So net rates, these are after reflecting sight account rate offsets. Again, treating the system as if it was one employer with two large sight accounts. The net rates are lower. Here we're presently in the 15 to 20% range. The dots stay pretty stable over the first four biennia. Two have already been set, two more to be set based on the 2023 and 2025 year-end valuation dates. And then the most noticeable thing here is the movement in the bars and the dots from 27-29 biennium to the 2029-31 biennium. What is that movement upward for? That is about the projected expiration of a lot of site accounts, which is why, I mean, this is why I think a lot of focus for next year's experience and method study will be alternatives and information on that. Bear in mind for the employers that have site accounts, these site accounts, the ones that were set up 20 years ago, were typically set up with debt, and the debt was scheduled to expire around the same time that these sight accounts were scheduled to expire. So, you know, it presents a concerning picture, but there's also the debt side of it that needs to be contemplated, and that's not included in our analysis. Okay, these are the change in the net rates, very similar pattern to the changes we see in the base rate, slight downward bias due to the demograph below zero, i.e. a decrease, slight downward bias for all the biennia, say one, and that's really due to the OPSERP replacing tier one, tier two, primarily, and then the one exception are those projected expiration of the site accounts, which would lead to a bump up in the 2029 rates. Funded status, what do we see? Well, we see, funded status was, this is excluding site accounts, was barely below 80% when we did last year's valuation. We think it's going to drop because of the year-to-date investment returns down into the low 70s, but then we get that kind of steady upward climb. Here you can see at the 50th percentile in our model, we get there at 2036. That's about 4 years earlier than the deterministic model that I showed you for a 6.9 return. Why is that? Our steady model has slightly higher returns than our deterministic model, and those slightly higher returns, if those extended over a 14-year period, they would accelerate the pace at which we get back up to 100% funded status. This is the same measure, but with including site accounts. So we start higher, but we kind of end up in the same place. We, in this case, again, focusing on the median. When do we get to the median? 100% at the median? We get there in 2036, because at that point, we're slightly higher than excluding site accounts. We still have a smaller site account that hasn't completely depleted yet, but there's less difference between these two metrics, including excluding site accounts, on the right-hand side of the chart. UAL, so this is the unfunded liability in non-inflation adjusted dollars. Here the pattern that we want to see. We want to see those dots in accordance with the policy going down. So this is kind of showing the pacing that we would expect under, and you can kind of, if an interested party wanted to, you could kind of take this chart, print it out, and place it side by side with our cumulative investment returns chart from a few years ago to say, okay, a what-if scenario, if I want to look in 2032, 10 years from now, if PERS investments was this amount annually, where would our UAL be at? You could kind of cross-tab those two charts against each other. This is UAL including site accounts. So very similar picture on the right-hand side of the screen. Starts at lower numbers on the left-hand side, given that there's less UAL if we include the site account assets in the calculation.
Just and, to be clear, I think I know the answer to this.
Sure.
You're assuming that the board continues to hold a 6.9% return. So there's a bias there between the 7.33
yes.
median return, if you will. Okay.
That's correct. Yeah, we have made no forecasts about the board's response to return assumptions. And there could be. There was an interesting white paper that was put out by co-authored by a gentleman who's, the CIO for Seattle City, along with J.P. Morgan, that, you know, there could be a natural responsiveness to this, that if markets do really well, outlook models, forward-looking outlook models will probably go down and return assumptions will go down. That's the pattern that we basically saw over a decade. Investments did well, return outlooks decreased, our assumptions decreased. And so there's none of that built into, you know, no anticipated forecasting built into this model, if you will. So we're kind of holding that piece in place. So then turning, I think, to the last bit of the stochastic testing, is this is something that we do every year. And I think it's, in my view, a little bit of an easier way to interpret some of these models is really the stress tests. So stress test is looking at those scenarios and kind of almost in a probabilistic sense. What's the likelihood of a good or bad thing happening? We try to use consistent tests over time so that interested parties can interpret it and we can kind of see how things, well or poorly, things are tracking in response to market changes, assumption method changes, you know, board policies, stuff like that. So here, this is an endpoint stress test. I'm looking at the funded status at the end of the modeling period, 2040 year end, so about 18 years from now. What do I take away from this? We think that it's almost a 2 in 3 chance that the plan would be 100% funded status at that point, and we think it's 7 in 10 that it would be above 90% funded status, considering that that metric right now is 73% to 74%. That's a welcome stress test result. It's kind of the outcomes are biased towards improvements in the plan's funded status over time. So that was an endpoint. This is every point. Here we run the in our model. We run the valuation each and every year for the next 20 years, and we look at the likelihood that either a good thing or a bad thing could happen. In this case, definition of a good thing would be funded status at some point, at least one in our valuations over the next 20 years is above 100% funded status. It's 3 in 4 chance, 77%. We also look at bad things. Bad thing would be funded status going down below 60%. That's about a 1 in 3 chance at one of those valuation dates. My commentary on this is one, you know, the results are a little bit better than they were last year. That's somewhat down to the modeling and the outlook risk. But the other thing, and then the one I'd focus on, is that the good outcome is almost twice as likely, or is twice as likely as the bad outcome. So that's a demonstration or a sense of sound design. And then my final nerdy point that I have to make every year is that if you add up the first good outcome and the first bad outcome, they add up to 113%, which is to say that in at least 13% of our scenarios, we get to both 100% funded status and below 60% funded status inside of a 20-year period, which is just kind of part and parcel with the size of the assets and the way that the assets are invested in appropriately in a return-seeking manner, if you will. Next stress that I look at is good and bad events from a contribution rate perspective, and this is looking at that collared base rate, so that the one that currently sits at around 25 to 26% of pay. So what I would direct the board to here is if we're currently about 25% of pay, what if that rate climbed up to 40? So about a 15% of pay increase. Or what if it dropped by 15% of pay down to 10? So, you know, it could have a symmetrical or kind of a 15% move up or 15% move down. Those are shown by the top and the bottom bars here. The good event, which would be a 15% of pay decrease in rates at some point over the next 15 years, that's about a 1 in 3 chance. Not likely, but it's 1 in 3. The bad outcome, that it moves up 15%, it's a 1 in 6 chance. It's less likely. So again, it's good to see that from a design perspective, the responsiveness of our policies, their ability to sufficiently fund the benefits, that the good outcome here is more than twice as likely as the symmetrical bad outcome, if you will. So that's kind of big picture stuff on rates, but there's kind of the small bore things that matter too. This is, you know, kind of the tote board that Director Linick could use if employers reach out to him or member services, staff or something like that. You know, what is the likely forecast? You know, so I know you're saying that our rates might go up 1%, but what's the likelihood that they might go up 2% or 3% or 4% or more? That's what this chart shows, treating the system as one employer for both base rates collared and the net rates for the increase that will happen on July 2025. That's based on where market conditions will be at the end of next year, calendar year 2023. We see a 1 in 3 chance of increase of at least 2% of pay. We see about a 1 in 4 chance of an increase of 3% of pay or more. On the base rate side, we see less than a 1% chance of a 4 or 5% increase. That number, 4% or more, is noticeably higher for the net rate. There it's 15% possibility. The net rate, all of a sudden we're bringing site accounts into the equation. Site accounts are pre-deposited assets. They kind of leverage investment returns. Leveraging of investment returns can be good or bad. They amplify your upward moves or your downward moves in rates, depending on how the markets do. So those scenarios where we have down markets, if you're in site accounts, it's going to add to your burden in terms of the rate change size. It's kind of turning the volume up to 11 in terms of your rate movements, if you will.
If that's true, why is it lower on the 2% of pay?
Why is it lower on the 2%?
30, so it's like on a 4% of pay move, bad move, if you will, versus the one that's sort of linear. It's, you know, 15 versus less than 1, so I get that. But on the 2%,
first row,
it's 33 minus, compared to 36.
Mm-hmm. Scott, you want to take a crack at that one initially, or you want me to?
Sure, I can start. So I think right now, many of the site accounts and the weight of the site accounts, they, prior to, you know, this year, there had been a number of years of good investment returns that are still working their way through the site account rate offset. So those, there's kind of upward pressure on the rate offset, which decreases the net rate. Like that's still coming through in the current cycle. So I'd say if we're at something that's near, you know, relatively near assumption on returns through the end of this year or through, next year to the next rate setting valuation, that net side account effect for kind of the weight of the assets that have been exposed and gotten those gains, still could make the net rate, increase smaller than the base rate if we're kind of in that bound. But if we're down to the scenarios where, you know, we're limited by the collar because this next, you know, 13 months ends up poor in the asset returns, then it's going to have flipped over and those recent losses on the side accounts are going to keep that from kind of helping against the base rate to make it more volatile on the upward side.
Yeah, thank you. All right, thank you. Okay, so that prior slide that we were talking about there is the next upcoming scheduled valuation, rate setting valuation, which is the July 25 increase. We know 9 months of the returns or 10 months of the returns already for figuring out what that might hold. The one subsequent to this is on the following slide. And this is really showing what the kind of the tote board, if you will, for the 2027 rate increase. And we're seeing, you know, similar results to what we had kind of last year for the one that's two out. You know, hey, there's a little bit less than a 1 in 3 chance of a 2% or more increase on either rate metric, about a 1 in 4 of a 3% of pay or more increase for both base and net. And then kind of that leveraging effect that, you know, the only way that you could really get to a 4 or a 5% is to kind of have those leveraged poor returns for the 2-year period that would run for calendar year 2024 and 2025. And that is, it's a two-sided risk. You know, what we don't depict here is the scenarios where those employers, where the markets do really well and those employers get the benefits of a good return amplified, just like in this case, they would get the risks of a bad return amplified for them. So, I think everybody's favorite slide, which is the wrap up. So we'll be back at the next meeting. We'll have, some preliminary year end 2022 investment results, at least on a kind of a public, I think we'll have publication from Treasury in time for that meeting. And we can kind of comment on what we think that might look like for the advisory 25 to 27 rates. And then we'll have a little bit of a kickoff for our every other year, legislatively mandated experience study process. And just like I think, you know, the, we kind of went through our paces a lot with the coloring with the recent study. I think that the site accounts and those kind of bumps a few biennia out are going to be a big focus about policy, and that's where we'll end up doing a lot of our deep diving next year, in addition to seeing what happens with the markets and outlooks for capital markets between now and the end of the year. So anyway, thank you, everybody, for your excellent questions and for your patience in letting us walk through this material.
So, Matt, we do have a little bit of time.
Okay.
So if you are inclined to comment on the GRS audit, we would love to hear about it.
You bet. I will take, that was brave of you to ask me to talk more. Thank you, Trish. The main thing that I will comment on right now is the 18-month delay, because that seemed to be the biggest topic. The 18-month delay factor, I'll start off by saying it used to be part of the valuation methodology. And when a colleague of Scott's and mine took over the work, about 15 years ago, after kind of listening to stakeholder feedback, reviewing the reports, one of the first steps that we took was a recommendation to remove the 18-month delay calculation because, and I think GRS alludes to this in their report, it added a lot of complexity to an already complex situation. But I recall some of the feedback we were hearing was, you know, there are employers in the state, particularly school district employers, that are pooled. And the rate that 18-month trying to true that up, you would have two school districts that were side by side with each other that were completely pooled that lacked site accounts, and they had slightly different contribution rates. And they were mystified about this. And it's why. Why? Well, it's because our rates are ever so slightly different because of the 18-month delay. So I will say, while we haven't brought it in front of the board, it was an intentional choice to try to, where we can, make the calculations more understandable without making them inaccurate. The next thing I noted, and I think it would be based on I can't remember if it was a question that Vice Chair Fernstall or somebody else, but the fact of that green line where the green line went up above 100% and kept climbing. An 18-month delay adjustment in and of itself is not biased. So if we have a good investment return, 18-month delay is going to bring more funding into the program than it would be if you didn't have that. Now, kind of stepping the bus back to the way I was kind of sitting over here when Jake and then Ryan were talking, I was like, oh, you know, raise my hand, you know, help me out. So think about the snapshot date for the valuation. December 31st, odd numbered years. We take a snapshot of liabilities. We take a snapshot of assets. What does the valuation do? We calculate a kind of a pure UAL rate that, and that this is my first opportunity to quote the singer Cher. If we could turn back time and start contributing, you know, get the valuation done, Cher walks on stage, we turn back time, you know, that's the UAL rate we would contribute right there. That's not what we're actually contributing. The valuation comes up with this based on where payroll and UAL liabilities assets were at that date. But there is a UAL rate that we're contributing. The 18 months thing comes completely down to is what we contributing right now. Is it above or below that pure rate, if you will? So the fact, you know, I think they were intentional in the memo and in the Jake and his memo and in the GRS report. It's, you know, should consider wasn't like should, must is because trying to kind of play all of that forward with all the mechanics for 18 months, playing forward payroll, playing forward assets, and thinking particularly what we've had for the first 9 months out of the year, would we play forward the assets with a 7.3% return assumption from the valuation date, or would we play it through with assets? Through, you know, at some point, the board has to adopt rates and communicate them to employers. We can't wait right up until July 1 to say, okay, this is what the markets did for the first 18 months, so here's your new rates. So it's there's a little bit of a be careful of my word language here. There's something to be said for not being too cute by half in terms of modeling something that's a long-term funding enterprise. We, you know, it's kind of actuarial purity is honored, and we are sacrificing any ability for folks to understand the underlying calculations. All right, I've probably said too much, so I should stop.
So what's the industry standard?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, Chair Shinoy. It is standard. I mean, any system is going to have a delay. The only systems that won't have a delay would be single employer systems where they also have the financial flexibility. I mean, I'll use the gentleman sitting to your left as an example. So if it was a single employer plan, potentially like a chief financial officer could say, well, our reports come in. It's come in 7 months into the year. I can see this is the number. I can allocate a lump sum and get that in by the end of the fiscal year. We do not have that capability in PERS. No other statewide system has that as well. Time delays are always going to be part of the process. It's just kind of, and there's not a bias to them. It's part of the process. It's part of the methodology. And it is a policy decision, about, you know, it's not a slam dunk about this is the right way to do it full stop or this is the right way to do it full stop. There's trade-offs. I know, Kevin, do you have anything on it?
I agree on that front. And as well, one of the other things was, you know, when salaries get decremented and given the fact we have 900 employers, who have different collective agreements that take effect at different times. And for instance, state employees, sometimes you move up a step on your anniversary date, which can scan, you know, the full 12 months. Again, you can get too cute and, you know, just add another layer of complexity to an already complex system.
Yeah, I should dial back some of my for an actuary mean remarks and say that, I mean, in terms of the review that was done for the Secretary of State's office by GRS, I think that they did a very thoughtful job and I appreciated significantly Ryan and his team and all the questions and ideas that they raised. And as we did with the last study and as we would with any audit, we will have significant discussions with Kevin and with Jake and kind of come back with written responses. And we have taken things from prior audits and enhanced our reports in response to those.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, as always, Matt and Scott.
Thank you. Thank you.
Kevin, anything else too?
Chair Shinoy, I have nothing else. No.
Okay. All right, then. Next meeting is in the new year, February 3rd, 2023. On behalf of the board, I want to wish everyone happy holidays, happy new year, and see you next year. This meeting is closed.
Just one question. We'll start audit at 11.
That sounds great.
Sure. So for those who are listening in, we will start at 11. Thank you.
Bless you.